Juliet Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you.
Hello and welcome to episode 283 of Dogcast Radio, which is all about supporting your dog's physical and mental health and happiness. Later on, we'll be talking to canine herbalist Rita Hogan.
I really got into it when I was about 29 years old and I moved to Tennessee. I just started boarding dogs and I was very interested in herbalism, but I just thought there has to be a better way than giving me a bag of kibbles and a bag of pills.
But before that, we're exploring canine cognitive skills with one of the UK's leading trainers specialising in positive reinforcement, Kay Atwood.
Hi, Kay.
Hi, Julie. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I'm good. Probably not as good as you because you've just come back from holiday, haven't you? So you're well rested and raring to go.
Well, I don't know about rested after the washing, as we've said.
Oh.
But yes, I have. It was wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, good. It's always that back to earth with a bump. Not only are you home, but there's all that washing. I know, I do. I nearly put that in one of the messages. How's the washing going, by the way? No. We'll stick. Like with dog training, we'll stick to positives. We're going to talk about your wonderful book, Canine Cognitive Skills, which is an amazing book. Absolutely amazing. So let's jump in. I love the first thing you say. There's no such thing as a stupid dog. They've got cognitive abilities. Now, that's going to come as a surprise to many people, I imagine. But there's no such thing as a stupid dog.
No, there really isn't. And it was one thing that always used to kind of make me a little bit sad when people used to say to me, oh, you know, my dog's stupid. He'll never be able to do that. And I think he's not stupid. Of course he can. We just might not have found the right way to teach it or approach it. So they absolutely all can learn.
Yeah. Now, I have to say, I have been that person, you know, with my Labrador buddy, who was an amazing dog. And I learned how amazing he was. But there was a point where I would look at people doing heel work to music or whatever and go, that's fantastic. But he couldn't do that. And when I gave him the chance to do it, oh, my goodness, yes, he could. You know, I had trouble keeping up with him, but he wasn't the issue. You know, I was the issue of ending and the communication that we had to work on. But yeah, the dogs usually have it in them if you give them a chance, don't they?
Yeah, you find the right motivation, find the right environment sometimes, and make sure that it is correct in all aspects for the dog and sometimes for the, you know, the owner too, whoever's working the dog. You get that right. You're on your way there, really.
Yeah. Now, most people sort of know, oh, okay, we've got to give the dog a walk every day, which I know there's a lot of talk about that. Do we need the daily walk, you know, which I think is fascinating. So we know they need physical exercise. What are the benefits of developing dogs' cognitive skills?
Wow, such a loaded question.
Yes.
There are lots of benefits, and there are benefits for just general health and welfare. There are benefits for behaviour, reactivity, and anything else. And then there are benefits for the dynamics between the dog and the owner. For their relationship. So it's relationship and bonding as well.
Yeah.
But also it's just a lot of fun.
Yes.
I think, you know, not just for the dog, but also for the owner. Most of the people that I have done cognitive skills with, they can't wait to show it off to their family and friends. They're so proud of the things that their dog can do. And when you think that my masterclass, for example, they teach their dog how to spell their own name.
Wow.
And pick out the letters of their name from other letters in the alphabet. Teach them how to discriminate on sounds and noises. There are so many benefits. But I think also we have to remember that it also teaches both dog and owner that choice is of utmost importance.
Yeah.
And the dog actually learns that there is a choice because we give them a choice of, I just call it 50-50. One is right and one is wrong. And if we give them too much choice, that's when it becomes too difficult. Then it becomes frustrating.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember being on holiday and being given too many options when ordering dinner.
Yes.
And towards the end of the 2 weeks, I just thought, thank God I'm going home. I can just say, I'd like this, please.
Yeah.
Without going, do you want it like this? Do you want it like that? Too much options can sometimes be frustrating, annoying, and
yeah.
So
yeah.
If you just do 50-50, one is right, one is wrong, the dog learns so much from that. A, I do have a choice. B, if I get it wrong, nothing happens. Nothing. So that means I can then do process of elimination. The second thing has got to be right. So it also motivates them to keep trying.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of benefits in that alone.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, it's good for any, in inverted commas, problem, any unwanted behaviours, shall we say. It will help, you know, any problems that they're having. But it's also good for, I mean, dogs that don't appear to us to be having any problem, you know, a normal, in inverted commas, dog, it will help every dog, won't it?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Because it also, it can help with things like focus, duration of focus, listening, that type of thing.
Yeah.
It can really, really help with that. Reactivity, it's great for that because the dog starts to use a different part of the brain. And that part of the brain kicks in and just says, calm down, relax, you know, things are fine.
Yeah.
It won't solve reactivity, but you'll find that it will become less. And whilst your dog is practicing these cognitive skills gains, you won't see reactivity at the same level.
Yeah.
You'll see it reduced, if not at all. For example, when I've done workshops in the past, I've always allowed to have a reactive dog in the class.
Mm.
Obviously, they had lots of space, et cetera, et cetera. But reactivity was minimal considering they were in an enclosed environment with their triggers.
Yeah.
Barriers were taken away. And eventually they were working with a little bit more space, all said, but they were working with the rest of the group as an individual with their owner without being concerned about the other dogs and handlers present.
Yeah.
So using that different part of the brain really does help.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. An important part of anything we're doing with dogs is reinforcers. And you make the point that's individual and there's no need to be negative. And I think that's a really important point. And I do bang the drum for, you know, positive and reward based. But just tell us again about reinforcers need to be individual and there's no need to be negative.
Well, we can't say what is reinforcing to that dog at that moment in time.
Yeah.
The dog is the only one that can actually say, this is what I want to work for. But it's our job to find out what that is at that moment. Because it could be, you know, it could be a piece of chicken one day and he might go, well, I fancy cheese today. Okay, that's fair. You know, if that's what floats your bag, then cheese it is. But sometimes the reinforcer doesn't have to be anything edible at all. Sometimes it can just be being told by the person that you love, your owner, that, hey, you just got it right. And boy, did you do a great job. You're a fantastic dog. And you know what? I love you. That can sometimes be enough. I've had dogs like that myself in the past where food is refused and love and attention is far more preferable. And then I've had other dogs that would like both.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't?
Absolutely.
So, actually taking part in the exercises can become a reinforcer in itself. And I've actually seen the dogs become so excited when all the various pieces of equipment coming out because he knows exactly what's going on. He
yeah.
just goes, yep, we're going to do this, which I know we're going to do. I've done it before. Or if it's something new, he gets excited because it's something new and he wants to know all about it. So even getting equipment out can be a reinforcer and the dog is on board already.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know, I can remember years ago, we'd gone to basic training with Buddy and then I saw an alley-oop, which is a target stick, but it was an alley-oop on YouTube. And I kind of thought, oh, that's amazing, all the activities you can do with this, I'm going to get one. So we got one and I was so excited with it with Buddy and it was obviously treats and attention. And every time we got the alley-oop out, oh, he was so excited. We'd go to basic training and he was like, well, yeah, okay, I can take it or leave. And I thought, oh, this is the attitude I'm showing him. This is exciting. This not so much. And they do pick up on what you think and sort of what's exciting, what when do they get the treats? And so it's really important that you sort of make it exciting for them, isn't it? You know, you make it all, this is fun. Mm.
Yeah. And it's interesting you say that, because when I first started teaching cognitive skills in my classes, because it was doing things that were, I mean, obviously they're born from obedience, but because they were more, you could say tricks and that type of thing, but because there were things that they'd never done before, I went, for example, teaching a dog to choose, tell me the blue one and ignore all the other colours. And then the owners go, you did it. Oh, that's great. Their response to it was so much different, rather than good, here's a treat, or click, here's a treat. So their response, the dog was working off the back of that. So you're absolutely right. It's how we behave and how we can motivate them by being far more animated ourselves.
Yeah, yeah. And again, later on, I learned that with trying agility, because I got my treats and Lee said to me, no, get a tug toy. And I was like, it's not going to work with a tug toy. And of course it did. And it was just amazing. And I was like, okay, right, okay, this, I've underestimated this dog and I've misunderstood in some ways. So yeah, I mean, give it a try, because it's, you will learn so much. So that said, it's good for our dogs, it's good for us, it's good for our bond. How do we teach cognitive skills?
Well, everybody is probably doing some form of level of cognitive skills. But cognitive skills to me is anything that teaches the dog to think either outside the box a little bit more, or think on a different level, to think harder, not just, how do I make you make give me that treat? So it can sometimes be teaching something really quick, or it can be a chain of events and then the reinforcer is given. But basically, cognitive skills is something that includes or the dog using memory, short-term memory, long-term, and all those types of skills that are used. Now, some of them are used in everyday life. But in my classes, because we're doing things that aren't everyday life, like spelling your name, learning colours, that type of thing, the dog does learn to use his brain far more effectively to become a problem solver. Now, if you become a problem solver to your advantage to get what you want, then you're for those dogs, let's just say, that are reactive to something, they also learn that they can problem solve. Mm-hmm. So they learn that there is a solution to most things. And therefore, they start to think about things first before reacting. So they're thinking it through. What are my options here? Because that's what we're teaching in the classroom for cognitive skills. So using parts of their brain that they wouldn't necessarily use. If a dog is lured all the time, he's not really using that part of his brain that he could. But if we teach a dog not to do that and to problem solve, that's the start of lots and lots of new things for him.
Yeah. Yeah, they must feel so good with this. It's amazing. It's brilliant. And I mean, I've read your book. I'm going to hold your book up again, but Cognitive Skills, Canine Cognitive Skills by Kay Atwood. And it's mind-blowing. It's when I read particularly the advanced things, I was like, really? Really? Wow, dogs can do this? It's just amazing. But let's pull it back to starting activities. So how do we need to start? What's a good starter activity?
Okay, well, I call them my foundation skills. And foundation skills are all the things you're going to need throughout to use the exercises that go up, that progress throughout the book. So we start off at low level and then we end up at advanced. Okay, there are things that go beyond that, like spelling the names, which isn't in the book. But the low-level things are things that you need to teach the dog in order to play the game. So they would be simple things of look at what I'm showing you. A starter position, which might be on the bed. So the dog learns that that's like a little starter button that says when you're on the bed, things will begin. things like push, use your nose or your foot in order to show me your choice, and look for things, search for things, think about things. But they're the foundation skills that the dog is going to need to in order to progress through the games throughout the book.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, that's the thing, that these are games, these are fun. This isn't sort of, well, it's not necessarily useful in inverted commas, although it's useful in a different way than sort of everyday, like, it's not sit, wait, stay, hang on, wait, let me get the car open. And those are really, really valuable things to teach.
They're life skills.
Yes, yes, exactly, yeah. But this is, it's just, as you say, it's different. It's getting the dog to use their brain and approach things in a different way, isn't it?
Well, they're life skills, which yeah. all dogs need, but the skills that they'll get with cognitive goes on in the background. And they're the skills that the dog learns to use in life.
Yes.
If
yeah.
he wants to, if he needs to. For example, I do have a choice. I know what the choices are. I'm going to slow down and think about it instead of just going for it. So you can, they will take the skills into life skills.
Yeah, yeah. So once we've done our foundation skills and we've sort of got those commands set up and the dog sort of knows how to indicate to us, what's a good starter activity?
Well, one of the starter games that I use is searching for something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I like to use this, and I also incorporate short-term memory. So, for example, we might have a toy. Right? In my classes, I use a little flannel that I tie in a knot, and we play with the dogs with it first of all. So the dog learns, this is a plaything. I like it. I want it. We then ask the dog to go onto his bed, sit and wait, and we let them watch where we put it.
Yeah.
And we leave a little bit of it visible. So it's not a game of find it, because you've just watched me where I've put it. It's going to become a game of remembering where it is. Okay.
Yeah.
So then we go back to the dog and we say, go find it. He goes straight to it because he can see it. To progress from that point, we would then hide it in the same place, but hide it totally. And it might go under or in something. Now the dog is looking inside it. Well, is it under it? Is it in it? But I know from memory and history, it's in that place. Okay. Then we start to say, go on your bed. We go and put it where it is. It's completely hidden, but it's in that place. And then we'll ask the dog to do three simple tasks. Can you sit? Can you lay down? Can you give me a paw? Now go find it. So you've taken their mind off of it, and then you put your mind back on it. So we're doing a little bit of a switch.
Yeah, yeah.
Then we might add another hiding place, and we go through the process of that. Leave it out visible for a little bit, and then it will be hidden. Then it will be, you know, do some simple tasks, and now go and find it. Now we've got two hiding places, and we can also introduce various games for some memory. Do these first and then switch back on to task. If the dog goes to the first hiding place, he now knows, well, if it's not there, it's got to be in the other one. So when he does find it, we throw a party. Yay, you're amazing. And the dog just comes back with it in his mouth, like, yeah, look at me. So something as simple as that has got lots of tiny little elements in that is beneficial to the dog.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a simple one.
Yeah, and actually, but that's, you know, when you're trying to remember a number or something, and you know, you're saying it like, I don't know, 43, whatever it is, and somebody asks you a question, where's the potato peel? And you go, it's in the drawer. Oh, what number was it? 43, I think it was, you know, and it's a lot of processing, and it takes a lot of energy, and it's so fulfilling. I mean, it's difficult, but it must leave them so happy.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing, so people can't really get their head round that it's, if he's going to find it, how come he's watching me where I put it? So it's not really a game of finding it. It's a game of remembering where it was and switching back onto task.
Yeah, yeah.
So switching on and switching off is also a skill.
Mm, yeah, yeah. And it, I mean, I found dogs love this. I mean, we enjoy it because we can see them, you know, having a good time and the tails wagging and that, but dogs really loved it. And another thing that I found with Buddy, when he became older, he still loved this kind of gentle activity. Well, physically gentle activity. I was very lucky with him that he stayed mentally agile. But it was physically gentle stuff that we could hide the toy and say, OK, you go and find it. So it wasn't like fetch, run, jump. It was just gentle, you know. And there's such benefit from it for an older dog, isn't there?
Well, they're all low impact.
Yeah.
There isn't anything that involves running and jumping and that type of thing because it involves the brain.
Yeah.
And you can do that sitting still.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know, with not much movement at all.
Yeah, yeah. So that's, you know, that's a really interesting activity and I can see the benefit of that for the dog and you're building your bond. But the advanced skills in this book are amazing. I was constantly walking around to my family going, look at this, look at this, look at this. This is what dogs can do. They're amazing. Can you tell us one of them?
Oh, gosh, there are so many. But I remember years ago teaching counting. I thought, we can do this. We can teach them to count, you know. So I found these big black buttons on eBay and I bought lots of different black buttons. And in my head, for my classes, I had one particular class, actually. It was my Friday afternoon class. And it was people that kept coming back all the time. After every course had finished, they would come back. So it got to the stage where I was thinking, what am I going to do with them now?
Yeah.
You know, they've done all the obedience stuff. And I thought these were the class that I would experiment on. And they loved it as much as I did. So I thought, we're going to teach them to count using the numbers 1, 2, and 3. So that's exactly what we did. We had a blank piece of paper on the floor. And that was going to be our sample where we would put a button. And then on the wall, we had taped or blue tacked corresponding numbers with just great printed big dots on about the same size. Okay. So we would put a button on the floor and say to the dog, look, and then he would say, show me. So the dog would run off and he would indicate either with a nose touch or a paw to say, that's the same as the one that you've shown me. So it was a, here's your sample. Show me what this sample over there.
Yeah.
And it just blew me away.
Yeah.
So I was filming it one day and I was saying to my customer, now put 2 down. Now it's important that you put them in the right pattern, the right shape.
Yeah.
Because the dog isn't, I'm sorry to burst bubbles, but they're not ideally counting at that stage. They're looking at patterns and they're copying the pattern that they see. So 1 obviously is 1 blob. 2 is like it is on a dice, an angle. And then 3 was not in a row because that was too similar to 2. It would be like a triangle, 2 and 1.
Yeah.
So I was saying to my customer, now put 2 down. So we put 2 down and said, look, show me. The dog went to 2. I said, okay, put a 3rd down. Look, show me. The dog went to 3. I said, take 2 away. Look, show me. The dog went to 1. So it was clear the dog was looking at the patterns on the floor and copying them for what they saw at the wall.
Yeah.
And that was the day where actually I remember the very first video I took of it. And I heard myself say, oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when I realised she's actually doing it. It was a little working Cocker Spaniel and she was actually doing it. So we went on from there and that's when all sorts of cognitive skills were born.
Then you've got to start thinking, well, if you can count, then what else can I teach you to do? You know, the world's your oyster, isn't it? Where?
Well, I started to think about, you know, what would a 5-year-old child be doing at school?
Yeah.
They'd be learning numbers. They would be learning by counting in spots.
Yeah.
And then they would be using numbers. So I started to use numbers. This is number 1. Show me number 1 on the wall. This is number 2. Show me number 2 on the wall. This is number 3. Show me number 3 on the wall. And that type of thing. To the point where if you have a dog that is at that level, you could say, show me the numbers that equal 5.
Wow.
So you could show a 2 and a 3 and then say, look at 2 and 3, show me on the wall, what number is those?
Wow.
Now that is a much higher level.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
But you could do numbers, You could do with spots. You could do numbers as in the figures. And that means that you can also do letters. Yeah. And letters is something that we have done. So we've actually taught dogs to spell their own names, to go and pick from letters standing up against the wall and go and choose the letters that make up their own name.
Wow.
Now, that's a little bit clever.
Oh,
because
yeah.
It's actually done from texture, the texture of the letters that uses their name. So B-U-D-D-Y might be made of felt, but any other letter against the wall might not have felt on.
Yeah.
They might be the same colour. So the dog is actually discriminating against non-felt letters.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it looks like they're spelling their name, but there's no reason why going forward, because it would be much harder to teach them to identify that letter, whether it's got felt on or not.
Yeah, yeah. It's incredible. It really is mind-blowing.
The world is your oyster.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they can differentiate between little and large, different colours. The content of the book just blew my mind. It was just like, wow, this is amazing stuff.
Well, there's so much more that I do in my classes, etc., that isn't in the book. They can also discriminate against sound.
Mm.
You know, if this box makes this sound and this box makes that sound, and then you play a sound behind your back, the dog can actually say of the doubles that are in front of it, that one there makes that sound.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Incredible. I mean, as you say, we're tapping into their natural skills that they would have used for survival skills, I suppose, really, in the wild, or, you know, or if they didn't have us to look after them, which a lot of the time we don't give them choice. As you say, we present them with their meals, we present them with it like it's walk time. We're going, this is the way we're going, this is what we're doing, this is where you sleep, this is when you sleep, this is... And some of the time that's necessary, but when we can give them the choice to exercise these skills, it's good to do it, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even on walks, I always let my dogs choose, when you go out of the drive, do you want to go left or right?
Yeah, yeah.
You choose. And, you know, they often do choose.
Yeah.
It's a bit awkward when you've got four dogs and two want to go left and two want to go right behind. But
oh, dear. Then you've got a referee then. Oh, it's amazing. And it's just... There's so much in the book. I do recommend the book to people because it is mind-blowing.
Thank you.
You know, it really is. And just before we get to how good it feels for them, what breeds, you know, what is there anything you'd like to say about sort of breeds or sizes of dog or ages of dog or anything that can do this?
Well, as far as age goes, I usually say, you know, you can start really low level on foundation skills as young as you like. But there are some things I would say not to start until the dog is about 6 to 8 months. And that's purely because they're using their brain far more than they would, and they're using different parts of the brain for problem solving, they can get really tired.
Yeah.
And that means that it's important that you don't do them for too long. And it's important that you, if they're too young, they're going to tire really. All dogs will tire doing them.
Mm.
In my classes and everything, at lunchtime, if it was a workshop, we had to give them time to have a little sleep.
Mm.
And we gave them lots and lots of breaks. And at the end of the day, they were absolutely shattered.
I bet.
So as far as age goes, we have to think about how much rest they need, and on all dogs, but you know, 6 to 8 months would be the youngest, I would say.
Yeah.
Okay. As far as breed goes, they don't need to be, especially agile, because there's not a great deal of movement involved.
Yeah.
But any breed can take part and do this.
Yeah.
As we know, there are some breeds that are quicker in the brain than others. We just need to change or adapt the exercises to suit. For example, we know that border collies and poodles, you know, they're the ones that people say are the quickest. But I've had all sorts of breeds that I would consider have cottoned on to the game just as fast, and some, if not faster.
Yeah.
So The dynamic between dog and handler is also really important, because if their communication skills are on point, they're going to pick things up, because they'd be good at teaching each other and showing each other exactly what's expected. So they can learn it just as fast. So that's not breed specific at all.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, any breed, really, any breed at all. And I've had all breeds in my class.
Yeah.
All
yeah.
breeds. Even, you know, I hate to name breeds, because I don't like people to think that I'm saying that that breed is that is you know, has is predisposed to behave like that. But I've had all sorts of breeds that some people would consider to be really slow movement and of brain thought, and not and just a bit dim.
Yeah, yeah.
But they proved that actually they're not.
Yeah,
they're not dim at all.
No, no.
Like I say, there's no such thing as a silly dog.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. I sometimes think there are dogs, you know, sometimes the dogs that get away with doing less, it's like, well, I don't want to do your silly activity. Actually, there's not, you know, maybe we haven't got the right motivator, or we're not displaying the right right attitude, or I don't know, something can put them off. And it's sometimes the cleverer dogs that get out of doing the activities we want them to do. Thank you very much.
Yeah. You know, it might even be like, I just don't want to do it right now.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You've got to take it all into account. We are running out of time. I can see, as we always run out of time, but I knew we'd have too much to pack in today. So there's a couple of minutes. Is there anything else that you would like to say?
Oh, gosh. Do you know, this is a topic that is really difficult to talk about in just an hour.
Yes. Yeah.
So I would say, if you've got the book, great. Start reading it. Make your way through the exercises. If you haven't got the book, start thinking outside the box. I'm thinking about choices, about offering your dog various things to do, and only give them two things. One is right, one is wrong. That's a good starter point. Start to teach your dog all about choice. But it's not just about sit, stand, down.
Yeah.
And those things, if you do them too much, you can exhaust them for yourself and your dog. So you do need some new toys in your box, basically.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So
absolutely.
The sky's the limit. Don't ever get to the point and go, well, we've got as far as we can on obedience. There's nowhere else for us to go. Absolutely. There's loads of places you can start to go.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And it's fascinating. And it really is mind-blowing. It's just, you're like, wow, dogs can do this. It's incredible. Talking about places to go, where can people go to online to find out more about you?
Well, for me personally, my website is www.kay9services.co.uk. That's my website. On there, you can see all about classes and workshops that I do, etc. If you want to buy my book, it's actually from Performance Dog.
Smashing.
They are the publishers. But if you go on my website and you go to the shop, you can actually buy the book from that shop, from Performance Dog too.
Smashing. Thank you very much, Kay.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
The benefits of getting your dog's brain working never cease to amaze me. Huge thanks to Kay for sharing with us the benefits of developing your dog's cognitive skills. All the links Kay mentioned can be found at our website, dogcastradio.com.
You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
There have never been more ways to support and improve our dog's health, and herbalism can be a great way of keeping our dogs in the best possible health. To find out more, I'm talking to canine herbalist Rita Hogan.
Hi, Rita.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, I'm good. So, this is going to be so interesting. I don't know very much about... That's our mischief in the background, having a bark about something. That's okay. She likes to get in like, you know, get on the radio. Right, so... I'm really interested to talk to you today because I don't know very much about herbalism at all. Let's start off with, please, what is herbalism?
Well, it's the study of plants, both medicinally and nutritionally, and how plants can improve the body and life, basically lifestyle, life force, quality of life to those that ingest or use plants in the various different ways that various different modalities that they're available in.
Excellent, excellent. Now, you see, I'm...
How is that for an answer?
That's brilliant. That's excellent. And that really chimes with me because I'm vegetarian anyway. So a plant-based diet is, I think, very good for us. And it's certainly, I believe it's helped my health, definitely, on a personal note. So that's really important. I know our dogs sort of eat meat as well. And many of our cats and things have to eat meat. So, that's fine. That's fine. So how can herbalism support our dog's health?
Well, I mean, in many of the same ways that it will for humans, it can help you work in a preventative mindset versus a reactionary kind of paradigm in your relationship with your dog. It can help balance out the body so that you can bring down the need of a pharmaceutical medicine. It can help definitely elongate, have your animals have more longevity.
Due to
its positive effects on the body, depending on the plants and how you use them. So, I mean, I've been doing this over 2 decades and I've just seen, miracles with herbs and pets.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that sounds great. Because that's one of the things, that's the worst thing about dogs really, isn't it? They don't live long enough ever.
No, they do not.
Yeah.
I want my dogs to live until they're 80.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, I mean, on that subject, can you tell us some of the dogs that you've helped with herbalism, whether you supported a condition or whether you've extended their life?
Oh,
can you tell us?
I've worked with thousands of dogs, but, there's a few things that I would say that pharmaceutical medicine isn't very good at, right? Like Valley fever. Valley fever, I don't know if you have it there in the UK, but it's something here in the United States, in more of the desert regions, my opinion. Like California and Arizona and New Mexico. I haven't seen any of it here in Washington, but it's a hard one. And I've used herbalism to balance out that in the body, having the body take care of it, not really treating it, but supporting the body and like kind of the theory of where it starts. And that's been excellent. Elongating cancer dogs. So making a supportive protocol for different types of cancers, an herbal supportive protocol, especially a lot of dogs are just kind of like, well, we can't do anything,
Yeah, which is an awful diagnosis to receive. Well, that's it. We can't do anything,
Yes, it's just awful. And so, I have one client was diagnosed 4 years ago and still going strong.
Wow, that's brilliant.
Yeah, cancer is just toxification, emotional toxification and physical toxification. So, when you deal with those two things, longevity tends to increase depending on, your window. You don't know what window you have, your dog has. It's very expensive to run a ton of tests that, that a human would get where you can figure out what are we dealing with here? Those are really difficult in animals. So you kind of have to guess. But if you know how the body works holistically, then you can start supporting. So I've had lots of good luck with that. Mast cell tumors, lots of arthritic dogs, running around without the side, the symptom of arthritis.
Yeah.
Kidney disease.
Wow.
I don't treat disease because I'm not a doctor, but when you like kidney disease, you just support the kidneys and circulation and how filtration. So I support how the body works together as an ecosystem. And when I do that, the diseases tend to dissipate or get a lot better.
Wow.
So
excellent. Yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Happy dog, happy owner.
Yes, absolutely. And, the owners and dogs go hand in hand. They are our mirrors. There's so many clients I have that share this, their dogs share the same exact thing that they're, the mom gets glycoma, the dog gets glaucoma. I would say glycoma, but glaucoma, the dog has anxiety, the mom has anxiety.
Yeah.
And when I say, I'm always saying, the female, but 99% of all my clients are women.
Yeah.
So, because they seem to be here in the United States, definitely the ones that are taking care of the animals and bringing them to their vet visits and stuff. And not, of course, not in every case, but in a lot of them.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I think, most of our listeners are women, to be fair. And it's a very similar demographic to me. our listeners. So, yeah, there we go. But yes, it does seem to be a lot of women who I've met, some lovely fellas who have adored their dogs. And but you do meet, it's mainly women that I tend to.
It's predominantly women. And when I get a male client, I'm like, oh my God.
Yes.
You know, oh my God, I have a male client. But yeah, I mean, it is the way it is. And women, you know, for the most part, are the caregivers. They are the caretakers. And so you have to be really careful with that, with those lines that cross. And our dogs are so susceptible to the stress that we carry along with us.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. And I've seen our dogs behave completely differently when the trainer says, just give me the lead and I'll do this. And you kind of go, but they're all relaxed and happy now. And they you know, and they're channeling my anxiety about, oh my goodness, they're going to kick off or whatever it is, you know, and you think, oh, okay, I need to relax. So yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. So what was it that got you into herbalism?
Well, my grandmother was an herbalist. Wouldn't say that she, you wouldn't call her an herbalist. She just was someone living in the Great Depression that had 16 kids with just a midwife. You know, she'd go into, I share this story all the time. She'd go into the woods with her basket and come out hours later with, you know, whole bunches of things. And my mom shares these stories about her doing that. And also all the concoctions that the kids used to get, you know, herbal concoctions they used to get. But my dad also, we had a farm growing up and he used herbs on our chickens and cows and pigs. And, we hardly ever saw the vet. The vet came when there was like a problem with calving or foaling, for our horses and cows, so he had a lot of knowledge, I'm sure, that was brought, like, given to him by his father or his mother.
Yeah.
I wish I would have paid more attention.
Yeah.
You know, I would have paid more attention, knowing what I would be doing as an adult. But I really got into it when I was about 29 years old and I moved to Tennessee. And I just started boarding dogs and I was very interested in herbalism. But I just thought there, you know, there has to be a better way than giving me a bag of kibbles and a bag of pills.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and the dogs were so ill, over vaccinated and just over medicated. And it, you know, that was 20 years ago and it really hasn't changed.
Yeah.
There's so much that has changed, but for the, I think the bulk of dogs, it hasn't changed all that much. So it really got me interested in kind of using herbs and with dogs. And then one day someone asked me what I was or what I did. And I was like, God, what, how do I explain that? And I just said, you know, I'm a canine herbalist. And it was the easiest, most, like, it was just so easy to step into that.
Yeah.
Because, that's exactly what I was doing. Like I was, you know, I was mapping canine physiology or human herbalism onto canine physiology and really learning how things worked. And then I read Julia de Barclay Leve's book, way before I got my good start. And, you know, I felt so validated, you know, she's an English herbalist and, I felt so validated. And then I read another book, by Cheryl Swartz, who's a DVM here in California, just an amazing veterinarian. And I felt validated again. She was talking about herbs and pets and how the body works. This was, again, over 20 years ago. And then I got this book called Veterinary Herbalism. And I was like, you know, this is something. You know, the internet wasn't a big deal. There was nothing really on it besides, you know, making your own website for various things, but the search wasn't great, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You have a lot of information into it at the time. And so I had to rely on books and there just wasn't a lot of them at that time. So I'm like, you know, I'm really on to something here. And now we just have, you know, a plethora of information if you know how to mine it, right? If you know how to get it. And people writing great books and so I feel really blessed to be part of this, you know, this culture, all natural dog culture that I'm in, because it does offer a lot. And I also am very welcoming to the people that aren't in the all natural dog culture. I think that that's really important to help change their lives by taking baby steps and into herbalism. So the rest is history.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right though, in that it's baby steps, isn't it? However you're trying to improve life for your dog, whether it's, you know, with training or with the diet or whatever it is, the first time you encounter an idea, particularly if it's a big step, you kind of go,
yeah,
I can't do that. Whereas if somebody explains that you can take a, you know, take a tiny step towards doing that, and you think, okay, I can do that, I can do that. And then you can really start building on that. And I think that's absolutely the way to go.
Yeah. I you know, you don't want to be overwhelmed, and you want, you know, with herbalism, you really want things to be intentional, like it, you know, very intentional, and know the herb as an individual and know your dog as an individual. And when they come together and they're very well indicated, wonderful things happen.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds great. So what kind, I mean, I'm imagining that herbalism isn't something we just need to turn to when our dog is ill, when we realize something is wrong. Mm. As you said, if we can sort of, if we can do preventative rather than curative. So what kind of conditions, or life stages or whatever, can herbalism help with our dogs?
What kind of conditions? So, I mean, let's see, cancer, arthritis, acid reflux, collapsing trachea, ear infections, skin infection. I mean, autoimmune disease, histamine intolerance. I mean, I can't think of anything that it can't either help or at least support. But like what you said about, and what I said, and then you reiterated about working in a preventative mindset. What I really love is just doing seasonal healing with dogs and herbs and myself, in that, you know, Cheryl Swartz's book, she has a book called Four Paws, Five Directions, and it's based on traditional Chinese medicine, but she interweaves Western medicine in there, Western herbalism, not Western medicine, but Western herbalism, which I am definitely a Western herbalist. I use, herbs from the Northern Hemisphere, things that are outside my door, right? Like, and they're outside your door too, like blackberry and nettle and plantain and different things like that. And, but in TCM, there's something called a body clock, and it deals with the organs. And when you look at seasonal healing, you look at the seasons and what organs they govern. Hmm. So like right now, we're looking at the kidneys and the musculoskeletal system in the wintertime. And, you know, you'll notice that things tend to ache more in the wintertime. You get more urinary tract infections in the wintertime, or kidney issues in general. It's the best time to treat those issues. And it's also the time where you're going to get dogs that have weaknesses in those areas. You're going to have issues. So you want to be prepared. And that really helps you work from a preventative mindset. But if you just have a really healthy dog, you can support their kidneys during the winter, and then you go into the liver in the spring and you support liver health, right? And the lymphatic system in the spring. And then you go right into the summer, which governs the large intestine and the heart. The small intestine and the heart. And then into the fall, you go to the large intestine and the lungs, and you just keep on going, right? Yeah. And those are your systems in the body that really affect everything. And then you integrate the nervous system into everything.
Yeah.
Because the nervous system really affects everything.
Yeah.
So you can work in a preventative mindset. If you have a healthy dog, you can go, okay, well, I'm going to add some herbs into their regimen that support the heart and the small intestine in the summer. And they're very, you know, they're cooling herbs, and they're herbs that help the heart, like hawthorn and, you know, like gota cola for the large intestine. For the small intestine, and things that support digestion in the summer, you know, and then winter, you like mullein and elecampane for the lungs, which also, they also have an effect on the large intestine and working with the microbiome in the fall. it is a wonderful way to start looking at dogs as an ecosystem, supporting that ecosystem. And then, you know, if you have a dog that's ill with one of those, like say, for instance, you had a dog with heart disease, right?
Hmm.
You would know and want to get prepared for summer because that's the month that they're going to have the hardest, the biggest issues, right? So you can anticipate that and get them started on something and figure out what you need to be aware of and what you need to look for when your dog is starting to have weakness in that area during the summer months. Or if you have a dog that has lung weakness, right? Say they had some scarring from something that happened to them and their lungs aren't as great as your other dogs, right? You would know that they're going to need extra support in the fall.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or kidney disease, or a dog that suffers from urinary tract infections, most likely they're going to get one in the winter. So you could like use those types of herbs in a cyclical nature so that they don't get any.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. So how do we, if we can't, you know, if for those of us who don't live near enough to come to you, how do we find a reputable herbalist?
Well, you'd want to ask them how long they've been practicing herbalism.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have a website, you know. And my biggest thing is, you know, everyone has to start out somewhere, right? So there's going to be herbalists that, like a lot of my students, have been practicing for about 4 years. Like some of the people that work directly with me, they've been practicing for 4 to 5 years. That's a pretty good time. You know, it's taken me a good 20 years to know what I know. You can't learn it right away.
Yeah.
But, you know, a starting out herbalist can help like support, you know, easy things. And then they get more experience. But I think clinical experience, and when I say clinical, I mean working directly with dogs. I think it's the best experience. You know, you have people that learn things just in a class online, but it's just all in their brain and not in their, in as a manifestation of their hands and body and mind all coming together and then being out there in the field with the plants themselves and working with the plants themselves. I think that for the bigger issues, you need someone that has experience with that has worked with people. So you need to ask them, you know, what kind of clinical experience do you have? And that clinical experience, like I'm a clinical herbalist. I have my own clinic, but mostly it's online. I deal do it some, like I work with, like I'm going to see a vet tomorrow that I work with locally. I work with some vets locally. I work with them on the phone. I recently worked with a jaguar at a zoo.
Oh, wow.
You know, but it was over the internet. You know, I looked at their case and there's, you know, what they had on the cat and what was going on with the cat. But you need that experience. Because I remember when I started out, you know, there's so many cases I wouldn't take. I'm like, I can't take that. There still is. Like, I don't deal with dogs with diabetes. That's a disease. And so many herbs interfere with diabetes. And I just don't do that. I recommend them to an herbalist that's a vet.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't deal with congested heart failure. Some herbalists do. I don't. There isn't an herb on the planet that can work as well as a prescription diuretic.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when dogs are old and get congested heart failure, they actually need that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it can actually elongate their lives for a few years. Whereas if they just tried dandelion, which is a good diuretic, or cleavers, yeah, it's a good diuretic, but is it strong enough to push like a pharmaceutical? Because a pharmaceutical is like a hammer, right?
Yeah.
It pushes. And so I think a good herbalist, you know, needs to know what they can handle and what they can't.
Yeah.
Or what they want to do. There's places where I just don't need that type of drama in my life and stress.
Yeah.
Right. To think about I could potentially cause harm.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I never want to cause harm.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
To my knowledge, I have not thus far. And I use very non-toxic herbs and some more toxic herbs if I have to, but in very small amounts. So I think experience is important and asking questions about people's practice. And, you know, if you say, for instance, your dog had an upset tummy and he just kind of was puking in the morning, okay? you know, that's not something major. Someone that just has like a year experience, they could definitely help you with that. Or another thing that an herbalist starting out could help you with is like, what form of herb do you need? Do you need a tincture? Do you need an infusion, a decoction, a glycerate, you know, a dried powder? Like, they can give you advice on that. You know, like I said, people need to start out somewhere. But, you know, being an apprentice and working under another herbalist and seeing how they practice, because we all practice differently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all have like I dose differently than a lot of people. We all practice differently. And so like when you work underneath someone, you can see them, how they work, like how they do their cases, what kind of things they recommend, why. You can ask questions. And then when you get that experience, then you can start adding in your own kind of the way that you want to practice. There's herbalists that focus on certain subjects. I have a student who's blind.
Oh, wow.
And she's a phenomenal herbalist. She's so good. And her other senses are so keen. And she works with people that are blind or that have dogs that are service dogs or blind dogs in general. So she focuses on the blind community, which I just think is
fantastic.
And she does other types of dogs too, but that's like her focus. But she's an excellent herbalist.
Yeah. Yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah. So it's really fun to see the variety of people, but just ask questions for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it's horses for courses, like you said, about sort of there are conditions and diseases it can support and help. And then it's find the right person at the right time, isn't it? So, yeah. So if people want to, more of your advice and information, you've written a book, haven't you? The Herbal Dog. So tell me a bit about that.
Yes. So that book came about with, I taught a group of women. There was no men. I taught a group of women herbalism, canine herbalism, for close to 5 years. And so part of that book is just showing up for those ladies every week. It was every single week, every Thursday, almost without fail. I think probably in 4.5 years, we took maybe a total of 8 weeks off.
Wow.
So, I mean, it was like showing up to college, but without the spring break, without the break. I had to write a lesson for them every single week. And so it's really a product of the writing really came over a longer period of time. And then refining that when the book writing process started. And it's in two sections. So it teaches you holistic canine herbalism, which is different than allopathic herbalism, meaning that what herb is good for arthritis? That's not a question that a holistic herbalist would answer or could answer without knowing a lot more about your dog.
Yeah.
You know, so it teaches you about your dog as an ecosystem and about herbalism and about remedies and which ones to choose and all that stuff. And then it has some conditions that you can use to help your dog heal. And there's some that aren't found in a lot of other herbals. There's, you know, an antibiotic recovery protocol. There's a yeast recovery protocol. There's a vaccine recovery protocol. So I have those because those are kind of a lot of the causes of a lot of the other things. Like, and that I talk about diet and I really meet everyone where they're at. So whether you feed kibble or gently cooked or home cooked or raw or traditional raw, like prey model raw, it doesn't matter. My book still applies. I have a very thorough and deep materia medica, which is like I deal with over 30 herbs, and it's like a small resume of that herb, but it's specifically for dogs and dosages.
Yeah.
So I help you with dosages and starting out with dosages. Dosages are a long subject. So I give you a place to start instead of just saying, hey, yeah, you know, lemon balm is good for the nervous system. Well, a lot of people don't know what to do with that.
Mm.
Well, okay, it's good for the nervous system, but why is it good for the nervous system? And how do I use it? And do I use a tea? Do I use a tincture? I don't know what I'm doing. So my book really answers all those questions. So it's going to be a really good reference, I think, for years to come.
Yeah, sounds fantastic. So for anybody interested in herbalism, this is a must read, isn't it? It sounds great. A lot of information.
It comes out on February 4th in the United States. In the UK, I think it's like 2 weeks later it will arrive. But yeah, it's available for pre-order right now.
Excellent, excellent.
And you can get it in the UK, I think, on Amazon.
Great. Well, we'll.
I'm sure you can get it at other bookstores too. You just have to ask them to order it.
Yeah, yeah. We'll put the links into the show notes so people
okay,
can
awesome.
Go to the Dogcast Radio website and find the links they want. That's great. And of course, February is Love Your Pet Month. So that's really relevant at the moment. So if you're trying to do the best for your pet and show them extra love, this is a great way to do that, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that is in the book applies to humans too.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. I always like to talk to people about their own dogs. So please tell me about your dogs.
Well, one is growling right now. I don't know if you can hear that.
I can't hear that.
Her name is Gertie.
Yeah.
It's Gertie. She is a Victorian bulldog.
Yeah.
She's about 65 pounds and her face is beyond adorable. She's a very good girl. She's a little more on the confrontational side. But as long as she's home and not meeting other dogs, she's perfection.
Oh, bless her.
She's very good. Then I have a little bulldog. Her name's Wheezy.
Yeah.
She's your like traditional bulldog. You know, small, big head. She's very good. She's our emotional dog. She's very emotional.
Yeah.
Yeah, everything she's her emotions rule everything that she does. She's also a Gemini. So, there's that. Very emotional people.
Yeah.
Always thinking. And the dark passenger, you know, she has been known just to kind of turn on a dime, but she hardly, maybe once a year.
Yeah.
Loses her mind. But she's sweet. And then there is Lola, who is a 15-year-old Basset Hound, and she has cancer.
Oh, awesome.
She is still, she's still running down the road, doing whatever, she's on a support protocol, and she got diagnosed a year ago, so she's doing good.
Excellent.
Yeah, and she has not slowed down. She had a couple moments when she first got diagnosed, and then we got her on a support protocol, and
brilliant.
She's doing just fine. She'll have bad diarrhea if I don't give her blackberry leaf.
Yeah.
She has to get her blackberry leaf twice a day, and we don't have any problem. But if someone forgets it, it's not pretty.
No.
And then I have two pugs that I co-parent.
Yeah.
And one is Figgy Nubbins, F-I-G-G-Y, Figgy Nubbins.
Yeah.
She's 12 pounds of terror. absolutely love her. She's a little pug, and then a little black pug. And then I have Ronan. He's also a black pug. And I absolutely adore those two. So they come to work. They come to work Monday through Friday. So.
Yeah. Perfect.
They're not here right now. They didn't come today, but they normally come.
Yeah.
But when I have a podcast, they bark a lot. So when I have a podcast, they're not allowed to come to work.
My dogs bark today. Well, our dogs bark today. So it just adds very similitude. It proves there's dogs around.
That's okay. We're talking about dogs.
Yeah, you real know. Dogs. Yeah. Oh. I've got, as always, I've got one eye on the time. So we've got about 5 minutes left. Is there anything else that you'd like to say?
Please pre-order my book. But
of course.
Besides that, I think the biggest thing that people need to realize is that you can't learn this stuff overnight.
Yeah.
You just take your time. You learn one herb at a time. And, you know, if you learn about one herb a month, right, you've got 12 herbs by the end of the year. I have this thing on my course platform, which is canineherbalism.com, and I have this thing called monthly monographs. And so we deal with an herb every month, and people can go back and reference them or download it and everything. But the feedback I get about that is so awesome and makes me feel warm and fuzzy, because people are learning about the herbs. And, you know, a good herbalist probably uses less than 20 herbs, like on a normal basis.
Yeah.
So in 2 years, you could get really familiar with 24 herbs, and those 24 herbs could change your life and your dog's life. And I love the herbs that kind of call out to you. Like there'll be an herb that comes across your life path and it just keeps showing up and it just keeps showing up. A plant. Mine was Oriental Plane Tree. Like it just keeps showing up and keeps showing up. And you're like, well, there it is again. And there, oh, someone just told me, do you know about Oriental? You know, it just keeps telling me. And those are the ones that you should really pay attention to. Because they're trying to tell you something. And I love that about plant intelligence. They just keep showing up and keep showing up. And then you're like, that's the plant that really needed my help, right?
Yeah.
Or need to help me. And that just, you know, let, if you are open to it, they will show up.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. Tell us the website again where people can find out more.
Canineherbalism.com. And right. Then I have another website, my consulting in store, canineherbalist.com.
What a great way to support our dogs. And I love the attitude of supporting them, doing no harm, and using herbalism as part of a holistic, inclusive approach. Many thanks to Rita. And don't her dogs sound wonderful? All the links Rita mentioned can be found at the Dogcast Radio site, dogcastradio.com. That's all we have time for. So until next time, look after yourselves and your dogs. Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. What do you call a sneezing dog? Achoo! Wow.